Namotasa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhasa. Namotasa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhasa. Namotasa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhasa. Uttang Dhammang Sangkang Namasami. So we have a chance tonight to sit through till 12 o'clock. So if you can, make the effort to do that. Do walking or sitting, but basically just try not to go to sleep before 12 o'clock. Sleep is a very attractive thing, and there can be a lot of aversion to not being able to take that posture. And to develop the endurance to look at that, it's actually quite a skillful thing to do, and very much a part of our force tradition to not just go with that which is comfortable, to be able to be aware of that of discomfort quite deliberately, not as a form of self-mortification, but as a form of investigation, so that one's practice isn't just limited to comfort sitting, just sitting when one feels comfortable, or sitting for a certain amount of time where one feels comfortable, but to actually look at discomfort, look at not getting what you don't want and getting what you don't want. And it's very important to be able to reflect on what the mind does with that. Because a mind which is only abides in its comfort zones is a mind which is still. Or a practice which is still very limited and weak. But once we start to get outside of our comfort zones and we're challenged in some kind of way, then we really see, are we aware of the khandhas as conditions that arise and cease, or does that a sense of self get attached to? And do we then carry life as a burden? And sleep is certainly one of the. It's an important thing to get sleep, and our culture is very afraid of not getting sleep. So our culture says, you need 8 hours or 10 hours or 12 hours. So the cultural norm is actually get quite a lot of sleep. Cultural norm in Thailand is that you sometimes push yourself to look at what it is when you don't. Get that chance to lay down. So different people have different energy systems. So I know I've had seizures from not sleeping. So that can be very harmful, not to get enough sleep, but to actually do the experiment, to actually push yourself in some kind of a way, which is not, again, not from self-mortification, but to just look at what happens when you don't have what you want. And when you get something that you don't want, it's like fasting, learning how to fast. And most of us, I think any monk who's been around for a while has tried fasting for 5 days, 10 days, things like that. It's quite a normal practice. And you can't live a lifetime like that. That's not possible to do that. But to, especially in the early years of practice, to push those limits, to push those boundaries, and to see, what does it feel like? What does it feel like to not get what you want? Or to get what you don't want. The extreme is the other extreme is just to do these things out of willpower, willfully sitting through meditation, willfully denying yourself sleep, willfully denying yourself food. That also is part of the experiment. Part of the mistakes that we make is just simply blind acts of will with no intelligence and no wisdom. Some people have chronic sicknesses, so they cannot endure the same kind of ascetic practices that others can. So it's not a matter of comparing yourself to others too. So for some person, an ascetic practice might be sleeping 5 hours, another person, an ascetic practice might be sleeping 12 hours if they have chronic fatigue syndrome or something like that, and with food too. So it's not to be in some kind of a competition or comparison, watching how much this guy sleeps or how much this guy sits or how much this guy eats, that would be rather childish, wouldn't it? But to have enough integrity and self-reflection and manliness, I think, a kind of sense of manliness of okay, this isn't an easy path. How can I raise the ante in some way? So the 12 o'clock sitting is a kind of a very minor variation on that theme. In Thailand, we sit till 3 in the morning, and then we have the morning meditation. So Thailand, it's really an all-night sitting. Here, it's a bit different. So do take the opportunity then to try to do that. For most people, I don't think it's really that difficult. And if you feel sleepy, then do walking meditation or standing, whatever might work. I think the challenge, like the challenge of monastic life, is it's not monastic life isn't a kind of self-improvement course. It's where you somehow your psychology somehow getting more comfortable and better. It's a whole different, much more radical approach to consciousness, and that, of course, is enlightenment. The non-grasping of the khandhas, the end of greed, hatred, illusion, the realization of the unconditioned. And this is a project which is much misunderstood, probably. And it requires a kind of deep curiosity in what the Buddha was talking about, what he was indicating, what his enlightenment was. So there has to be a kind of deep curiosity about the Buddha's teaching, not just about one's own perspective on what I need to do. That to some extent is true, but what I need to do can often come from a place of kind of cultural, popular kind of cultural norms. But the Buddha's teaching is actually quite radical. So study. Study is necessary, not just reading something kind of easy and popular, but actually taking something maybe more difficult and pondering and thinking, what did the Buddha really mean? So there's a kind of challenge intellectually too. Intellectually, one takes the challenge of the teaching and tries to engage it in some kind of way. Dependent origination, cessation of suffering, what is the use of the terms like dukkha vedana, dukkha lakana, dukkha satcha, which I was talking about this morning. These are, you know, what are the five khandhas? What do they mean? What do they mean in the structures of Buddhist ideas? Because if you don't get those basic Pali formulae down, and one just sort of reads in a kind of hit and miss populist way, usually intellectually you don't really have a piece. You might have interesting bits and pieces of different teachers commenting on bits and bobs of the teaching, and then the popularization of that, and so on and so forth. But really, you need to do the intellectual work as well. So that requires seriously looking at these structures of dependent origination, four noble truths, not in a superficial way, but actually learning them, memorizing them, and then letting them come up in your consciousness, just like the word perception, say, of the five khandhas. It's like take a year with perception, give it a year, rather than I know what that means, but actually, what is perception? If the Buddha emphasized that, what does that word actually mean? So you refer to the texts, you refer to your own mind eventually. And that kind of investigation where you take the teaching in a serious way, and you take the structures of the teaching as a way of as an avenue for investigation, that's very fruitful. But it's intellectually more difficult than, say, just reading a kind of popular rendition of Tuesdays with Maury or something like that, which are, you know, maybe fun to read, and, you know, sentimentally they can be quite opening and so on and so forth, but actually there's nothing wrong with them. But some kind of intellectual vigor is very helpful, because that, what that does, it helps to guide the investigation. So it, to some extent, it helps intellectual doubt. Doubt is deeper than just intellect. Doubt is also one of the hindrances, and it's one of the three fetters. But just getting that down, getting the study down, is very important. And that, I don't think that really comes through talks that much. People want university courses to do this and all that, but I think it just comes down, you just do your own homework. At least that's what I've always been trained. Because sometimes I think Western culture, people want, they want a course, and they want a structure, and they want a retreat. And it's kind of, sometimes I think it's like holding your hand. You know, please lead me through this retreat, and so on. It's all very well and good, but if you really have this aspiration to Nibbana, then you should be, you know, kind of going into it and say, what did the Buddha teach? Rather than always expecting like a course or some curriculum to kind of guide you through it. I mean, they're not bad, they're okay. But there's something about one's own initiatives and curiosity and investigation which are very powerful, rather than having a teacher always kind of set something up for you, and now we're going to study this, now we're going to study that. Rather the sort of manly vigor of like, this is an important teaching. These are important teachings. I want to understand these. Where do I have doubts? Where do I find the sources for that? How do I investigate that? And that's Dhamma Vijaya. That's taking this teaching deeply. I'm surprised that sometimes people who've been coming to retreats, they just don't have a real background in the formal study of it. And they've never really, I find, never really been curious about the basic structures of Theravada Buddhism. Maybe that's the fault of the teacher, maybe. But I think if one is really taking Theravada Buddhism as one's vehicle, then one needs to kind of really investigate the basic constructs and ideas. And they are all of peace. Four Noble Truths fits with Paticchasamuppada, fits with three characteristics, fits with the five khandhas, fits with the ten fetters. They're all really of a piece. They all make a lot of sense. But if there isn't a concerted and systematic study of it, like taking something like Four Noble Truths, breaking it down to the eight characteristics and the different ways that Tanha's talked about and so on, if one doesn't just do that kind of homework, then you don't get the teaching as a piece, you get bits and pieces. So some people will just kind of read psychology books, or then they'll read pop, you know, they read like a Dharma talk from a teacher, which is from Ajahn Chah or whatever, which is good, but they oftentimes won't understand the background that has been done. But say Ajahn Chah, he studied for 7 years, so he had a good background in the structures. So this is encouraged, but it's very personal. One has to just do it because one's interested. And to read something which is difficult is, again, sometimes I think Western culture tries to make everything, dumbs it all down. And, oh, that's too difficult, let's make it easy. But then that plays to the lowest common denominator. You know, the person who has the least amount of intellectual patience, I think. So whatever game you want to play, it really is up to you. But certainly, I think it's an important part of yati study. So we have the concepts, and we have the structures, and then applying those is also study. You know, applying something like dependent origination to your own consciousness. What does that mean? Or applying the three characteristics to your own conscious experience, so that your perceptions now, the way you're looking at conscious experience, is no longer from some bit of Carlos Castaneda's or Carl Jung or Rumi, which are all okay, but they're not sort of all dispersed with all these different perspectives on consciousness. They're actually quite focused according to how we think the Buddha was instructing us. So they are very powerful avenues for reflection. And so there's the internalization of that, of those structures. If one has good intellectual structures, then other teachings are one has some perspective. So one reads something from Advaita Vedanta or reads something from Rumi or whatever, there's a kind of intellectual perspective within which to contemplate that. But if one has no fundamental grounding intellectual principles, then one just gets kind of inspired, goes from A to B to C to D, and the intellect needs kind of to be entertained and stimulated and inspired in ways which are not actually can be quite trivial or very transitory. So Pariyatti, both study intellectually and then study internally. But you take now you have a basis now. You have Four Noble Truths. There's suffering. Suffering has to be understood. Suffering has been understood. There's the cause. The cause has to be abandoned. The cause has been abandoned. There's the cessation of suffering. It has to be realized. It has been realized. There's the path. The path has to be developed. Has been developed. You start to take those ideas and then take the ideas around what is craving, bhavatanna, vibhavatanna, kamatanna. You take those ideas and you start to look at your own mind through those ideas, no longer through popular psychology or the latest opinion about DNA or all those ideas, but you actually take those as your focus. And as you take those as your focus, then you begin to observe what the Buddha is suggesting you observe. Not because it's dogmatically correct, but it's actually efficacious, it works. The Buddha's teaching wasn't an attempt to dogmatically define everything. It wasn't a kind of philosophical structure which the Buddha took out of thin air and just laid it all down. The teachings came through time, but basically they came from his own realization and his own contemplation. And they're always, the teachings are the reflective teachings rather than belief teachings. If you believe in the Four Noble Truths, so what? If you believe in change, so what? And that really isn't going to be effective. So the challenge is to bring up the perceptions that the Buddha is suggesting, bring up perceptions like craving. What is craving? Bhavatanna, vibhavatanna, kamatanna, what are they? What does he mean? What does the Buddha mean by bhava, becoming, vibhava, getting rid of or annihilating, or kama, sensuality, hedonism, and so on? What does he mean? And when is that operating in the mind? And when does that cease? How does that cease? What does cessation mean? And what does it mean to realize cessation? What does that mean in your own mind? Realize cessation. What does that imply about what you have to see or how you have to see? So the mind has questions, but they're more from a kind of silent inquiry. They're from an inquiry into the nature of consciousness. The teaching is it's like that talk we heard just from Lompo Cha, where the monk has a cart and he thinks he has a 10-wheeler to to realize that you need a lot of barami to do this work, to get, you know, the realization that someone like Lompa Liam has is a lot of barami. So there has to be kind of determination, but humility. You have to be quite determined. You really have to be willing to endure a lot, to look at a lot, to give up a lot, and be humble enough to keep at it, to keep at it again and again and again. So it's a strange combination, determination and humility. Determination without humility can be a kind of willful arrogance. Humility without determination can be a kind of meek whimpering to life's difficulties. But the kind of humility we're talking about is not demanding a result, not demanding anything. Like Ajahn, when we read Ajahn Liam's biography, and he says, you practice for the sake of practice, just do it for the sake of doing it. That's the kind of humility of not demanding any kind of specific result, just doing it because it's right, because it's appropriate. So when we cultivate this path of anatta and the path of dependent origination, one of the things we are looking at is why is life burdensome? How does life become burdensome? When does life feel like you're carrying a mountain around? When is life a constant entanglement? When is our attention just constantly entangled with thoughts and worries in the future and the past? And, well, how does that entanglement work? Because that's obviously not freedom. Why the preoccupation? How does it work? How does it come up? Quite often you have the, if you look at, like, in your own practice, where do you start to find relief in the practice? Where do you feel that the practice is working well? Where do you find joy in the practice? It seems to me where you find joy is when you begin to let go of things, when the mind is no longer burdened by all kinds of old programming, where the mind is just really free and attentive to the way things are. And this is not something that is so much of attainment as an unburdening, as a relinquishment, as a disbanding, as a letting go. And so much of the language of Buddhism is around attachment. What are you grasping? Why can't you just be free? Why make it a problem? Just this way now. Why do you have to keep thinking? Why are you always thinking about the future? Why are you always getting angry at someone? What's with the fear? How come you doubt all the time? Why can't you just be quiet? Well, what's going on? And this kind of inner observation is not inner obsession. It's not inner judgment. It's not critical. It's just noticing, why can't I just be at ease? Why do I have to make this a problem? And that really is Four Noble Truths. It's First Noble Truth. You have to understand suffering. Understand it rather than judge it, try to get it rid of it, compensate it. So you start to question, don't you? You look at, well, what's the big deal? What's the drama? Why the melodrama? Got enough food, got a roof. People aren't killing me. I can go to the hospital, taxes are paid. Why make it a problem? And so that kind of honesty of investigation, you kind of begin to awaken to the entanglement of thought and self and other, and how does that work? And the attentiveness, the ability to attend to that, not to get rid of it, but to kind of be a like an investigator, a contemplative. And that's not a technique, is it? It's not a technique that you do. It's an honesty. It's a curiosity. Why can't I just be quiet? Why does my mind keep having to criticize and judge and make a problem? Why? What's going on? suffering has to be understood. You have to stand under it. You have to be with it. You have to be in the midst of it. If you look at, like, it just takes something like aversion. It's a gross example. If you see someone walks in the room and they do something which you feel annoyed at, and that annoyance, then you look at that person and what can't it be different? It shouldn't be like that. Stop doing that. I don't like you. Oh, you're coming into the room again. Oh God, I don't want to be with you. So you think it's the person that creates the mood, but the mood creates the person. They're interdependent, aren't they? The more I believe in that mood, the more I see the person that way. They shouldn't be that way. They're doing this, they're doing that. They should be different. And so the mood creates the person, and the person's activity reflects back in the mood. And it's actually one thing. You know, delusion thinks, well, I'm here, and the person I dislike is over there, and they're doing that, and if they didn't do that, then I'd be okay. I'd be all right. Or, I shouldn't be like this. I shouldn't be thinking like this. Same thing. It's the same delusion. I'm someone. But actually, when you just see when you see aversion as a particular mood of the mind, it's just that. It comes and it goes. Then that whole drama falls away. They fall away, you fall away. Because the person is pointing back to the mood. It's interdependent, it's dependently originated. With aversion as condition, there's that person. When aversion is not as a condition, there isn't that person. Not that the person doesn't exist, but that whole drama in your mind is actually one piece. It's not you and him. It's all one drama. It's one stage going on. Greed, same way. Our friend BL that we spoke about this morning, who attracts in some particular way, and then there's a greed or lust arises, and the more the sign of the person, whatever they're doing, their shape or whatever, feeds the greed feeds that projection. You know, it's just one thing. It's not me and that person, it's one thing. It's dependently originated. With this as condition, there's that. When this isn't, that isn't. Quite simple. So when I can see a mood of the mind, if it's greed, and I just see it, just the mood that comes and goes, that person, that mood, that falls away. Self, other falls away. And there's emptiness. Emptiness of that. And you have some worry about future. Possibility of failure or difficulty or whatever. That's a mood. It's like a person. The mood comes up. The unknown. And the fearful mind feeds the unknown, feeds a kind of image of the future. A future possibility. I'm going to be there and that's going to happen. That's going to be bad. The mood creates a scenario. The scenario feeds the mood. They're one thing. They feed each other. And then you know, it's just the mood of worry. It's the mood. You see it as dependently originated, that's all. And the whole, it's like the drama keeps collapsing. Because that's all it is. It's just a drama. There's no substance to it. What gives it substance is ignorance, believing in it. So if I, you know, grossly, I don't think any of us are there, but if I really believe in my anger, I really believe that that person is all wrong, they shouldn't be that way, that belief, that's ignorance, creates them, creates me, it's one piece. But as soon as it's known, it's just anger. It's just the mood. And all of a sudden, that person's gone. This person, the whole scenario, it keeps collapsing, it keeps collapsing, it keeps disbanding. The whole construct keeps falling away into emptiness, into silence. And that's letting go. So we're not trying to reconstruct anything, but we do actually. We reconstruct it through some, you know, I shouldn't be thinking this way, I should be thinking another. It's the same construct is coming up again. So we keep re-engaging with the five khandhas, with thought, with judgment, with hope and all that, but it's the same kind of ignorance. So Buddhism isn't about becoming a better person, although that might happen, and I hope, you know, it does for most people, but that's not the project. That's not the project. It's about disbanding the whole sense of personal identity. And that's radical. It's very, very radical. Very radical. So any self-perceptions that come up in you about that, you know, that you're skilled, that you're unskilled, that you're marginally skilled, and any comparisons and all that, they're just structures that come and they go. You can certainly, they can have a kind of a conventional truth. So someone who's studied Algonquin for 2 years in heritage carpentry, you could say, you know, they have skills in heritage carpentry, which is true. Conventionally, it's true. But it's the self-identity that the Buddha was saying, don't create anything out of that. There are skills that get manifest in the world. So that I'm a heritage carpenter and I think I'm doing well, and then I make a piece of work and the person insults me. So you 2 years in Algonquin? No way. If I take that identity, then aversion arises, then there's that person doesn't know anything. and that seems so very, very real. But as soon as, oh, this is just a mood, that with an insult, there's aversion arises, with insult as condition. And you could see how the insult creates the aversion, creates the person, the perception of the person. And it's just one thing. It's just one thing, and you keep disbanding it, which isn't like becoming anything. It's cessation, and you have to realize that. You have to see that. And sometimes you see cessation, you think, well, it's some kind of final product, which I'll get to whenever, and then never again will my mind move in any kind of negative way. Maybe. But you can also see it moment by moment. You can see this disbanding of self, the disbanding of craving, and that has to be realized. You have to make that conscious now. Oh, this is it. This whole scenario disbands, and there's just silence. There's no becoming. Non-becoming, non-aversion, not a problem. And then realize that, oh, that's it, I see it. And realization, ceasing, realize. So the mind becomes more and more conscious to that, more and more aware of that. And then there's an inclination to experiment, look, taste that. So notice how the mood creates the object reflects back to the mood, and it's really one piece. Whether it's worry, aversion, delusion, doubt can come up. You can just intellectually spin yourself in circles for a day. Don't know. You should be thinking all the time and not see that the creation of a question. You know, what we do in Western culture, we create questions and think we need answers. Modern science does that, doesn't it? You get an experiment and you get 100 more PhDs from one PhD. And the idea that just because you ask a question you need an answer, you know, it's a delusion. And yet you see, oh, the question creates the need for an answer, so we just let go of the question. Where'd it go? We see doubt. Doubt is doubt. Doubt is a condition. Nothing more than that. But if you don't know that, then the craving to know, the craving to have an answer, to crave and be secure intellectually, takes you into more thinking and more questioning. Is there a primal mind? And it goes on and on and on. But in any moment, you say, oh, this is just doubt. There's the mood of doubt. And as you know, there's the mood, it disbands. This keeps falling away, keeps falling away. And you realize cessation. You know it. You see it operating. So the kinds of the whole sense of time that arises in consciousness, based, you know, sense of self is based in time. It's chronological time. But psychological time, self time, me time, I was born and I will do this and I will do that. Not that they're wrong, they're still chronologically in some way correct, but that whole sense of me as a person moving through the planet in some way, that's also a construct. It arises and ceases. How to live then? Well, you live through precepts, you live through responsibility, do what you have to do. But this movement of life is in awareness. This movement of time, psychological time, the movement of the body through space and all that's in awareness. Rising and ceasing, in awareness. The sense of self is in awareness. It rises and ceases. The conventional perspective is I am here and I'm going there and I'll do this and I'll do that. And that's correct too. That's the conventional way of looking at things, and that's a necessary part. But this other way of seeing time as something that comes and goes, seeing sense of self as something that comes and goes, seeing that the my perception of you depends on the mood in my mind, that I create you rather than you making me in some way. And the creation of self and other is one piece. So realize, like, the disbanding of things. What does letting go mean? What does non-grasping mean? Why do we talk so much about non-grasping, non-attachment? What does that actually mean? And you can't figure out intellectually, you have to do it. Am I non-grasping now? You know, that kind of thing. No, you have to have the cessation of self. The cessation of becoming, these kind of things. Okay, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Andamayam ovada dhamma kataya sadhu karanga dhamma se sadhu 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 anumodami.
So practice on your own. If we could come together at 11:15.